Just as you thought it was safe to open your web browser again, we're back. It's Blind Line for 2000. I'm Jonathan Mosen. If you haven't joined us before, we're here at this time every week, and our mission, and we've chosen to accept it, is to bring you the best in blindness-related talk. We're still the only blindness-related talk show exclusively for the blind and visually impaired, and we appreciate your support. On the program for today, we'll be speaking shortly about a very important issue, and that is universal access. We're not just talking about cell phones and video machines and a few of those appliances that have always been a bit screen-based and graphical and challenging, but we're now talking about essential things like washers, microwaves, stoves, the common radio, stereo systems, things that we've been traditionally able to access before. So it's more than about computers, it's more than about tricky appliances, it's about everyday things, it's about our very independence, our dignity, our survival as independent, self-reliant people. This is the whole question of universal access. We'll be dealing with it in just a second as we speak with Dr. Greg van der Heijden from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Afterwards, your chance as always to speak with us about any issue that you like. I thought we might have a chat this week about the implications for blind people of the AOL Time Warner merger. Mind you, I read in the Wall Street Journal that investors appear to be a bit unhappy, particularly AOL investors are a little bit worried about AOL getting their hands soiled with all this old technology. And of course a similar thing happened with Lycos about a year ago, so maybe this merger won't go ahead, maybe the AOL investors will rebel, because the share price has been going down for AOL since the merger was announced, so we'll watch that with interest. But we have to assume it is going to go ahead, and what does it mean? This convergence of old media and new is happening. People are wanting to free themselves from the computer so that they can surf the net on their cell phone and their television, and that means challenges for us. So really the whole theme is universal access today. Give it some thought, have a listen to Dr. van der Heijden shortly, and phone in. We'll give you the details as to how to do that with Buddy Phone and the regular telephone after the interview with Greg van der Heijden, and we look forward to your comments. But now, Dr. Greg van der Heijden, the man that many of us have heard speak before, he is an advocate, a passionate advocate for universal access, and somebody who is certainly making a significant contribution in this area. For those who aren't familiar with his work and the work of the Trace Center, I asked Greg to start off by telling us a little bit about what the Trace Center is and what it does.
The Trace Center is a rehabilitation engineering research center. There are about 13 funded in the United States, and each in a different area of focus. And we have the Rehabilitation Engineering Research Center, which is focused on access to information technology. And we also work on the one that is focused on telecommunications. So we actually have 1.5 RERCs here.
And the overall theme that's binding this together is universal access, is that correct?
Yes. The focus of the centers is how you design standard technologies so that they are usable by a broader range or everyone. Rather than trying to say, well, we'll have special versions for special people, the goal is to try and figure out how you can create something which is accessible across disabilities and to anyone, not just people who have disabilities, people who are older, people who are driving a car and who either can't or shouldn't be looking at something. People who are in a noisy environment and can't hear a product that they're trying to use. So you can actually have a functional limitation due to circumstance, as well as having one due to disability of some type.
It's an interesting argument that advocates often have as to whether to pitch for the moral and increasingly the legal argument that says we have a right, both moral and legal, to this, or whether you actually do a softly and try and broaden the market for these sorts of accommodations. Do you have a perspective on that? Do you have a middle ground?
Basically, we've done a study of why companies do or don't practice universal design or accessible design, or whatever you want to call it. And it turns out that there's lots and lots of different reasons why particular things did or didn't happen at particular times, etc. But there's only really two things that ever account for any meaningful or sustained use of what we would call universal design. And they are regulation and profit. Everything else, it just doesn't really matter at the end of the day. And actually, it really boils down to just one, which is profit. Regulation comes into play because you can't make very much of a profit if you're spending it all on fines or if you're in jail. So regulation really is a way of causing something to fit into the profit equation that doesn't normally fit in the profit equation. You basically make it unprofitable to not do it. Now, at first, people may say, well, you know, that's just really terrible. I mean, it's a very cynical way of looking at things, that everything is profit and nobody in the company cares about anything else. And the answer is, well, it's not cynical. It's just sort of reality. The first thing that I ask in a situation like that is I ask the audience, how many people in this room own stock or own a mutual fund? And, of course, you get lots of hands, if not everybody. And then you say, how many people here pick the mutual fund or pick stocks or ask people to pick stocks for you that make the most money for you? And how many of you ask people to pick stocks that have any other criteria? And, of course, a couple people say, well, you know, I like to buy green stocks. But mostly everybody, and even the green stocks, they want the green stocks to make the most money. So the reason that profit drives the whole process is because the owners, which is us, the stockholders, that's the only thing that we look for, it's the only thing we value, and of course it ends up bubbling down the pike. Now, the second piece that's important to understand is, and this is interesting because it came to me from the chairman, I'm sorry, from vice president of a major corporation. And we were sitting there and talking about this stuff, and he said, you know, I never thought about the fact that people with disabilities used our products. And he said, this is really important, and I'm going to take this back. He says, but why don't you pass a law that says we have to? And after I asked him to repeat himself, because that was so surprising to me, he explained. He says, I'm going to take this back, and I'm going to put it on my desk. And I think this is really important. This is something we have to do. But when I get back there, I'm going to sit down, and I'm going to have a number of other stacks on my desk, and two of them are going to be smoking, and at least one of them is going to be on fire. And while I'm putting out that fire, another one will burst into flames, and another one will start smoking. And when I go home tonight, hopefully the fires will be out, but not the smokers. I know that. I'll come back in the morning. A couple of the smokers will burst into flame, and then my secretary will walk in with three more stacks, at least one of which will be on fire, and one of them will be smoking. And at the end of tomorrow, I will go away, and the next day, and the next day, and every day, I will be doing this. And a year from now, I will be putting out fires and smokers, and your pile will still be sitting on the corner of my desk.
So are there sufficient legal enforcements for accessibility in the U.S. and pretty much throughout the Western world? And I guess there's a lot of variation about the place, but are you satisfied with the degree of legal enforcement that exists?
No, I'm not at all. But legal enforcement is a tricky animal. What we want to do is to, in the words of the vice president, he said, if you pass a law, then your stack will begin to smoke. What you want to do is, there's two reasons you want enforcement. If there is no enforcement, then there is no smoke. We had a Section 508 law, which required that the government purchase accessible products. And the government is pretty big. And so if it buys accessible products, then you end up with a lot of accessible products because you want to sell to the government. But it turned out that it didn't show up in many of the purchase orders actually put out by the government. Nobody policed it. Nobody made sure that, in fact, the law, once it was passed, was followed. And so companies that started to get things accessible discovered that, in fact, it wasn't being enforced, and they backed off. And suddenly there wasn't anything. And even people in the companies who had actually started, you know, the ball rolling, advocates within companies, got themselves in trouble. They called up and said, hey, look, you know, we went out on a limb. We said that this was coming. We said yada, 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 and it's not happening. So there has to be enough enforcement that is taken seriously. The second reason that we need enforcement is that companies, the second reason the same vice president with the smoking sack said, he said, the other thing is if you pass a law, I don't have to worry about the fact that if I take time to think about this, my competitor is going to be thinking about something else and going to jump up. If I know my competitor has to do it as well, then it's not a problem. If I don't know my competitor has to do it, then I can't afford to think about it. We call that a level playing field. It's, you know, you're not playing where everybody's running downhill on one side and everybody's running uphill on the other. And so the enforcement is important there. Now, you asked, do we have sufficient enforcement here? Well, two things. One, we just passed the Telecommunication Act, and this is the first law that we've ever passed that says that everything that is manufactured, in this case telecommunication products, has to be accessible if it's readily achievable. And in the past, we've had different kinds of laws, but we never had one that said you need to, from the beginning of design, think about people with disabilities and build it in if it's readily achievable. Readily achievable, by the way, means with little effort or expense. So it's not like you have to kill yourself doing it. But if it's not hard to do, you damn well better do it. And the FCC put out the regs, and they're talking tough. They're saying, look, we expect you to do it. And they have all sorts of remedies. Nothing has ever been done yet. The regs just barely came out, the regulations. So we'll see where it goes. But the long and short of it is that industry is hearing the FCC saying no uncertain terms. Yes, we expect you to get up to the plate. The other one, the 508, the regulations, a new 508 was written, and it was written in a way that's much easier to enforce. And it is now, the regulations for it are due out sometime in the next couple months. And so that we don't gotten to the enforcement point there. The third thing we have, of course, is the ADA. And the ADA basically says if you offer services to the public, then it's got to be accessible to people who have disabilities in the public as well. They have a right. You cannot discriminate against them by creating a building, for example, that you can't get into with a wheelchair. And there have been suits that have been taken in, but not very many. Everybody thought that, you know, that the disability community would spend all the time in court suing everybody, and a lot of the stuff got put right into building codes, and so nobody had to sue anybody because the building codes, once you stick them in the building codes, then instantly all of the building inspectors go around, and basically if you don't follow building codes, the building inspector says, I'm sorry, you can't build it. And if you build something and you don't have approved plans, you just have to tear it down and build it again. So by incorporating the accessibility standards into the building codes, it basically made a very, very sure kind of enforcement. Now, we're currently working on ATMs and ITMs. An ATM, of course, is a banking machine, and an ITM is any information or transaction machine, and that's anything from a fare machine to electronic building directory. There are no regulations in general. There are some on the ATM, and there's a whole bunch of banks all got offered letters saying that unless they made their things accessible, that a suit would be brought, and a bunch of banks now have stepped up to the plate and made public commitments and entered into agreements saying that they would make their ATMs accessible, particularly the individuals who are blind or have very low vision. But again, it was the threat of a lawsuit under the ADA that has caused movement in that area.
Just while we're on the subject of the accessibility of public facilities, do you have any comment on the NFB's lawsuit against AOL?
No comment.
Fair enough.
It's early in the game, there is a lot of question around that. There's actually some action about people who would actually like to have the Internet excluded from the ADA. And basically, I think on the basis of it's such a tremendously vibrant driver of the economy that nobody wants to do anything that might slow it down. But if it is, you know, so important to everybody, and it's such an incredibly focal point of our economy, that actually, I think, should speak to why it needs to be accessible. And the problem is that there's an awful lot of misunderstanding and belief that making things accessible will make them ugly, hard to use, or just double the amount of work. And in fact, it's usually possible to make things accessible with little effort, other than in the beginning, you usually have to learn what it is you're trying to do. But that's just sort of, if you've never done anything before and you have to do it, it takes time to learn about it and talk to people and figure out what you're supposed to do.
Yes, one only needs to read the coverage that was promulgated around the time that the lawsuit was filed to know that there is incredible ignorance out there, in the media in particular, but I think reflecting the public in general about what's involved and how blind people, people with disabilities, use computers.
Yes, and what it takes to make it accessible.
Mm.
And they would see things like text-only browsers and think that meant that you had to have a text-only site, or that the most accessible site was one that was text-only, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, that's not true. Again, I think that most of the fear comes from the fact that people don't understand what, in fact, is being asked for, and they will get somebody who will stand up and very authoritatively say something that is scary as heck. And if that were true, you know, I'd be afraid of it. But it isn't true. But sometimes it's really hard to root those out.
And then you're in a critical position in that regard, because you have the ear of some pretty key people in terms of making a difference, making things accessible. You must have to ensure that you take safeguards to know that you're reflecting the collective view of blind consumers. And just to illustrate this point a little bit, I noticed that AOL have been saying in the last couple of months that they're interested in developing a special interface for blind users, which I'm not sure is what blind users actually want. They want AOL to work with their existing screen reading technology. And another example, of course, is a few years ago, many people in the banking industry thought that the accessibility of ATMs was solved simply by putting Braille on the keys. They thought, oh, this is wonderful, aren't we great, we've solved it. And in fact, blind people were really not a lot better off. So how do we ensure that what you're asking for, what you're advocating for, is actually what blind people say they want?
Well, first of all, I never represent what blind people want. What we do instead is we have them talk to several blindness groups, because even talking to a group which represents and is composed entirely of people who are blind. Well, I mean, you know, ask any human being what all human beings think. You know, forget disability. Nobody can really speak for other people. There are some people who have spent time going around and asking, and they would say, well, in my discussions, what I hear or what I think people who are blind are looking for. Even in your comments, you said, well, that AOAO was saying this, but you didn't think that that was necessarily what blind people were looking for, which is precisely the way to phrase it, because nobody, you know, nobody really knows, and quite frankly, people who are blind is the same thing as saying people. Their opinions, their backgrounds, their expertise are all over the map, and many, many would love to have an AOL browser that had built-in access, because they don't have a screen reader, they don't have a computer, but they could get a computer, somebody could launch the program for them, and they could sit and browse without having to pay another $700 to get a screen reader. Other people who already have a screen reader and are very adept at using it would like to use it instead of having to go learn some new interface. And so, right there, the answer is that both answers are right and both are wrong. The question that AOL will need to come down to is to sit down with blindness community or communities and try to find out what it is that is a good general purpose solution that will address the needs. It may not be exactly what each person who is blind would say was their first choice. But heck, we don't have a browser. I don't get a browser that does what I want. But as long as there is something that they're doing that allows people who are blind to use it, and then, you know, that would mean that their site is accessible. As it is right now, there are elements of their site which it's not, is this the best way for you to use it? There is no way for you to use it, and that's the concern.
I guess one of the things I've noticed in the last maybe 3 years is that there has been a change in the emphasis of concern within the blind community, and you may have picked up on this long ago in terms of observing trends, but it seems to me that there is more and more concern now about access to just everyday appliances, and that in general we have reasonable access to Windows, with the exception of a few notable products, but that now what we're worried about is the very simple things like using the radio and the stereo and the microwave and things, and I know that you've been doing a lot of work in that area.
Actually the trend is not different in terms of people who are blind interest. They've always been interested in those things. The difference is that they used to be able to use them. We are now finding stoves where it's all push buttons and displays. And before, there were knobs, and you could grab the knob, and if the knob didn't have a pointer on it, you could either glue one on or carve one on, and then you could turn it, you could tell what it was pointing to, and so you knew which burners operated, which knob operated which burners, and you could turn them and you could tell what you had set them to. But when all you have is an up and a down button and a display, you can push the up and down button, but you have no idea how much up and down you've set it. And so whenever you have what I would call an eye-hand coordination control, and that includes things like mice, clearly, but it also includes these what we call relative control. That is that you can move it up or down from where you are, but you don't know where you are unless you can look at a display. Then if you're blind, you're in trouble. And we've actually had people who were walking in, and there was only like one stove left that they could use. And this is a real problem. And either they can use the burners, but they can't use the oven, you know, things like this. They can't use the timers. So Microwave oven, same kind of thing. You know, sometimes they can memorize the sequence and sometimes they can't. Sometimes you can't find the buttons they're supposed to push, even if they would memorize them. So this is a real serious concern, and we are working on techniques. We have something we call easy access, which is a strategy that we are started with on ATMs and touchscreen kiosks, and are now generalizing and hope to be able to apply across most any appliance. There's also something new that I'd like to bring to your attention, and that's called AIIP. We'll call it AIP for short, but it's an Alternative Interface Interaction Protocol. And what it is, it's a way for one device to talk to a second device. Let's call the first device an accessor, to use a term of one of my colleagues, Neil Scott. And the other is, we'll call, a target device. And so let's say you're deaf-blind, even, and you have a Braille light, which is a small paperback book-sized device with a Braille display and keyboard. And you'd like to be able to set the time on your microwave. With AIIP, that would be a protocol that you would use that if there was a way for the two devices to talk together, you could have your Braille light, you'd say, give me a list, and it would give you a list of all the buttons on the front of the microwave along with the display content, and he could read it on the Braille display. And then he could send commands back using the Braille keyboard, and the microwave would act exactly as if he was pushing the buttons on the microwave or on the alarm clock or on the alarm system for the building, so that he could get into the building without setting the alarm off, or on the any other device that he wanted. Now, this also would allow somebody who is completely paralyzed using a sip and puff wheelchair to be able to control all these same appliances. Now, that of course means that there has to be some way for the coffee pot to talk to the Braille light. And there's two parts to that. First of all, there have to be some physical way, either a connector or infrared beam or radio waves or something else, for them to talk. And then they would have to have a language that they would use to talk. And AIIP would be the language. And AIIP could go over anything. So you could use it on an infrared link. You could use it over the internet. And all of this would be a little bit high in the sky, except that there are two things happening. Well, there's one thing happening. There's two or three big companies competing for it. Genie, J-I-N-I, from Sun Microsystems is one, and the other one is Universal Plug and Play from a small company in Washington called Microsoft. two technologies both seek to do the same thing, and that is to allow it so that all of the products in the future would be able to talk to each other. For example, when you walked in and you plugged in a television set, and then you plugged in a VCR, the VCR and the television set would discover each other. And so then when you went and sat down on your couch and you pushed on, your device could say, you know, VCR or TV. If it said VCR, it would turn the TV on, and the TV would then, if you pushed play, the TV would immediately change to the connection to the VCR, because it would know that the VCR can't play without the TV set being on and without it being changed to the channel that would view the tape. And so you can do this kind of a thing. You can have it so that things automatically connect to each other and talk to each other and exchange information. You could make it that when you set your alarm in your bedroom, the alarm would ask you, do you want to change, I noticed your, you know, the coffee pot set for an hour later, do you want to change the coffee pot to an hour early too? So that when you got up, you would have coffee ready, even though you normally had it set to go off at a later time. Well, as soon as they start having these intelligent households that work by just plugging them in and they just talk to each other over the household wiring, then you now have the ability to talk and communicate, and for these appliances to talk and communicate with each other. You then have the ability, if you just add the AIIP protocol, to control them and to provide an alternate interface to them. And so now somebody with a disability who can't operate the remote control but who can do sip and puff would be able to activate and operate all of the items in the house, but they wouldn't have to do it by going and buying some special equipment or anything. It would just be part of the standard products. So that's something new that's in the future that's being worked on, but that we want to look at from an international perspective. So anybody who's interested in that general topic should let us know. You can find information about it by going to www.uniac.com, UNIAC for Universal Access. That will point you to the National Center on Information Technology Standards and the work going on there too.
So how far down the future do you think we'll actually see this being rolled out in a form that consumers will be using?
It will be just a few years when you see the Genie and the Universal Plug and Play. They're already, I think there is some product already now on the market that uses Genie. There's nothing that uses Universal Plug and Play. There's also an HAVI, I think it's Home AVI, which was another consortium. And because there's three of them, it's everything sort of stoppered up, because it's like when we had Betamax and VHS, and you know, unless something just says, okay, this is the one you're going to use, or two groups get together and they form a hybrid so that they both own half of it and then they're both happy. But unfortunately, half is owned by Sun and half by Microsoft, and that's the two biggest players on that, and those aren't two groups that are trying to figure out how to work together right now. And the models are quite different. The Microsoft model has there being a computer someplace in the network running a Windows that is kind of like the master controller. The Sun Genie is more like peer-to-peer, where there's nobody in charge. Everybody sort of gets together and they sort of, each product works it out with the other products, kind of thing. And I don't know exactly how that's going to play out. The AIIP part is a standard that we're trying to get developed, so that's going to take some time. And then after you develop it, you've got to get people to build it in, and that takes time, and. So it's hard to predict.
I wonder whether we're in our darkest hour in terms of access to these sorts of appliances, because when I mentioned on some email lists that we'd be talking, I got a couple of emails from people who said, you know, this is really starting to frustrate me as a blind person. Nothing, no one seems to be taking any notice. And they also asked me to ask you, you know, if you perceive there have been measurable benefits, that people are actually listening and that access is now improving as a result of some of the research work and the discussions that the Trace Center has undertaken.
Well, let me separate Trace from your question. I've always said that Trace does absolutely nothing and has never done anything by itself. That anything that we've accomplished or anything that has been accomplished is something that was accomplished by many people, and we were part of it. if you open up the control panels in Microsoft Windows, any of them, NT or 2000 or whatever, you'll find a disability access icon, and in there is about a dozen disability access features. And I think all but one or something were written here at the University of Wisconsin. And so people would say, well, surely you can point to that. And I would say, no, that was a result of work we did. I mean, yes, we wrote the code. And but disability groups working and putting pressure on Microsoft was another big part of it. The 508 work was another part of it. Some individuals within Microsoft and their commitment to trying to do this was another big part. And so, you know, a lot of people, okay? So having said that, so separating the part of your question says, you know, are the things that Trace doing causing a difference? Why don't we just generalize that and say, are the things that are being done by people across the country in various levels, from advocacy groups to consumer coalitions to research groups, are they causing a difference, and are we seeing some change? The answer to that is yes. First of all, the ADA tier has had a tremendous impact in setting an original tone in the country. Then the Telecommunications Act, which requires that all telecommunication products be accessible, has really taken that whole area and caused this to be brought right up to the forefront. And for people to actually pay attention, right now they're not sure what they are or aren't required to do, but at least they know they're required to pay attention. And so they have groups of people actually trying to figure out what this is and talking and things like this. Third, we're in a very fortunate time in that almost everything has a microprocessor in it. I mean, your coffee pot, your shaver's got a microprocessor in it, for heaven's sake, that does nothing but control the speed and the battery charging. But as we have products that are controlled, where the behavior is controlled by a microprocessor, even little $10, $20 phones, it's possible to add some more instructions and cause them to behave differently on request. It is also now possible to add voice to almost anything for almost nothing. I mean, they have $5 greeting cards that have voice digitizers in them, so you can actually digitize information. I saw a little frame that was $10, and you put a picture in it, you record a message, and you send it. And then people can hit the button, and there's a picture of you in the talks. Because of those technologies, it is possible to add voice to products. We would like every product to have a little green diamond-shaped button on it. And if you push that button down and then touch any other button, it'll tell you what that button is. So you could buy a stereo if you were blind, and you can buy one that's got 30 buttons on it, and you don't care, because you only use 10 of them, and you can find those pretty easily by just holding the button down and touching. And after a while, you just go ahead and use it, because you know where they are. And if you're ever doubtful, you hold the button down, the green diamond, and you touch them again. And they don't do anything as long as you're holding the green diamond button down. They just say their name. And so they would say their name. And if you hit them again, they actually give you instructions on how to use it. And this is good not just for people who are blind, but for everybody who doesn't have any idea what half the buttons on their stereo are for.
It's very interesting you say that, actually, because I was recently training a sighted person to use a PC. And so that I knew what was going on the screen, I had a screen reader running. And she actually said that it's a shame that she didn't have one that she could keep on the system, because she actually found the speech instructive. As she was moving around the mouse, the screen reader was telling her the tooltips for the icons, etc. She said she actually found it useful. And for the first time, it made me appreciate that obviously profit, as you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, is a big incentive, and that if it's possible to demonstrate that there's actually a larger market than people think, then maybe we'll get some action a little more swiftly.
Well, that's what we do. Is very often, sometimes we get in under the mantra of accessibility, and the and then people look at it and they go, you know, forget disability, forget people with disabilities. This is just a great idea anyway, and you just smile and you say, okay, or yeah, that's common. Most of the things about accessibility are about usability. And if you make it more usable, it's more usable to everybody.
And then, of course, the demographics are likely to change because in most Western populations, people are aging. There will be a lot greater older people in the next 20 or 30 years. That's likely to have an impact too, I imagine, is it not?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that's true in I think most cultures, not just Western, because the... just because as you help to address infant mortality, the ages go up. But yes, we're having more and more living older and older. And we also have the baby boomers, the post-war baby boomers. And as somebody said, baby boomers are always in style because there are so many of them. And so hopefully we can get people to look at that. The problem you have, though, is that everybody designs things for themselves. Everybody believes that everybody else is like them. And most of all, the design is being done not by old people, but by young people. And they continue to design things with teeny tiny little letters, as if there was no end to the fine resolution that we can resolve ourselves.
When will we start seeing some accessible appliances really moving in the marketplace? Because I guess the perception I have, it may be an inaccurate one, is that people feel we've turned the corner. We reached our darkest hour, perhaps, in computer access in about 1995 when Windows 95 was released, and it took a wee while for most access vendors to catch up. People now, I think, feel that we've turned the corner in terms of PC access, but that things are getting worse and worse and worse in terms of appliance access. When do you think we'll start seeing perhaps talking mobile phones, talking personal digital assistants, things that we're really shut out of at the moment?
You probably first see it in phones, because there's a law here that says you have to do it, and as people address that, it'll tend to bleed over into other countries and things as well. We already have talking CD players for cars, radios. The trouble is they only make half the things talk. They make the things talk that they think the driver will want to use while he's driving, and everything else they ignored. There is a certain number of things that will become, as voice synthesis and voice recognition both continue to advance, you'll have some things that you can use simply because people who have a pocket digital assistant don't want to be constantly writing stuff with this little pen and stuff, and so they don't want to talk to it. And it's nice to have it talk back if you're driving or in the dark and things like this. And when voice output costs very little, then people will tend to use it more. The problem you have to be careful of is that you can end up with something where only those things which are useful to sighted people will show up, so that you'll hear systems that talk, but in order to talk, you've got to look at the display to know when to talk. I saw one that was really interesting, and it did everything. It was voice controlled, but you had to look at the screen to tell when it was you could give it the next command.
Yeah. Oh, you even get blindness agencies now who are stocking talking clocks that will speak the time okay, but it's impossible to set them with speech.
Oh, right. Yeah, but it talks. So what's your problem?
Exactly, you know? Right.
it baffles me sometimes that people just don't think. You know, it's like, well, when the light lights, you can talk. See, so it can be used with five people who are blind because you just talk to it. Little dictation units, and they're really wonderful, except the only way you can tell if they're working or not, or dictating, is if the little light is on. And so if you get out of sync and use the same button to start as for stopping. Now, I mean, that's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard, but we'll leave it as it be. But because if you push, and you just get out of sync, what it does is it records all of the spaces in between your talking. Because you stop it and you dictate into it, and then you start it and you stop and you think, and then when you're ready to start dictating, you stop it and talk. Because it's just, you know, 180 degrees out of phase from what you think you're doing. But I think that it's going to be a while before we see access. As I said before, you'll see it first in telecommunications because it's required. We may see it in some business things because the because of 508 and the government purchases and things. But I think it's going to be longer before we see it in other places.
You mentioned at the beginning, and I keep coming back to this because it's obviously critical, that profit's what's driving business, and that's perfectly understandable. So maybe it's important to emphasize that disability organizations in these sorts of issues need to look for strategic alliances, I would imagine, to try and demonstrate that the market for what they are asking for is sufficient to make the organization take note and realize that they could be losing a potential revenue, potential custom.
That's good. Quite frankly, though, I'm somewhat pessimistic about disability communities being able to make a market argument. From the standpoint that, first of all, a small number of people with disabilities are very early adopters. They have money, and if a product's going to help them, they go buy it, because they always are looking for things that will help them accommodate the world as it's currently set up. But a large percent of them aren't really in a position to get stuff right off the bat. Okay. Number two, that if all of a population were to buy something, and they were to buy your brand, if you've got 80% of the market, and everybody who's blind jumped on board, you'd see a really small increase, because any one particular disability group all by itself is not a very big number. If you take all the different disabilities together, they do add up. But so there is a, if you really try and sit down with it and you try and make the case by waving your hands, it sounds good. When you sit down and really try and crank numbers, you have to remember that for them to do something, they want to get like 5% or some large number increase or additional market or something, and that's, there's almost no disability group, maybe learning disability or something like that, that really constitutes a huge market share. And then of course you have the problem of what's your penetration within it stuff. The idea of strategic alliance, however, I still think is very good. But what you do is you can try to say, the features that we need would also be needed by X. And you try to look back to the main population, and you'd say, if you got a phone that can be used by people who are blind, and it's real easy to use if you're blind, then maybe you got a phone that somebody else can use without driving in a ditch. I know they shouldn't use their phone while they're driving, but you know they do. And you know they kill themselves. And you know that if they had one that was really easy to use while they're driving, that every time one of them has had a close call, they would be thinking about, geez, you know, maybe I'd have that other one. If you have something that's really easy to use by individuals with cognitive disabilities and things, maybe you'd have one that you could actually give to your grandmother or someone else who may or may not have high cognitive ability, but who may or may not also have high technical interest. And a lot of times, these things would be very useful to people if they were very easy to use. But if they're complicated, man, they just take one look at them and they just say, you know, take it away. And so we can build strategic alliances with large sections of the main population. And that's another way of doing it. In other words, to show how your need is the same as a larger number of people. But don't stick in the disability community. I think it's great where you can. For example, phones that talk work for people who are blind. They work for people who have low vision. They also work for people who can't read. But they also work for people who can't read, not because of a disability, because it's a second language. And they just can't figure out what all these... They buy a phone and they can't use it because it's got all these commands on it and they have no idea what they mean. But they could push a button down and it could talk. It may even be able to talk in multiple languages.
What do you think the world is going to be... Or what do you hope the world is going to be like in 10 years' time in terms of its accessibility, in terms of the way that people with disabilities are included in it and able to function in it independently?
I hope, my number one hope, everybody said, you know, what's the biggest barriers to people with disabilities? And the answer in the past always has been attitude. And the answer today, of course, is different. It's attitude. I mean, it's the same. Maybe attitude and understanding. If people could understand that you can create products that are more flexible, that do not cost that much more, and by that much more I mean like a tenth of a percent, or maybe even 1%, but they're really more usable by everybody. That there'll be a shift. 10 years from now, voice will be so common that I think it will be hard to find things that don't talk. And many people will turn the talking feature off. You know, you always hate things that are just yakking at you all the time. But they will talk on request. They may also be things that you can control by talking to them. And that may be increasingly common. I don't know how fast this things talking to each other will happen, but I hope that the people can get their heads straight enough to move forward on that, because in 10 years' time, it will be so easy to build so much processing power into things. I don't know if you know this, but the Nintendos that you buy at the store today have more power than the Cray supercomputer did in 85. there are, you know, microprocessors throughout your car that are more powerful than the computers that used to run corporations. And what are they used for? They're used to figure out whether or not the taillights burned out. I mean, it's crazy. We will see that the cost for technology. I have a picture here in my hand of a person. And on the tip of their finger is something that's about the size of your little fingernail. And it is a web server. It is a complete web server. It talks TCP/IP. You can connect it right to the web. And in fact, it is connected to the web. It was created by a grad student. And it's the world's smallest web server. And you can actually log on to it. And you can browse it from your website. You just go to your website and you can... actually go onto it and look at the pages of that he's got programmed into it. And so you can have this little bitty chip sitting inside of your thermostat, your furnace, your clock, your television, whatever else, all of the things. And you could sit at the office and check in on them. And you could make sure that your heater is working, your furnace is running, the thermostat is at the right temperature, that the security system is all secured, that it's turned on. I mean, these are all things. I mean, it will be to the point where everything that you own could be on the web. That's kind of scary, about what all people can do in terms of hacking. But these are all possibilities. And so it's possible for them to all talk to each other over the wiring. So anything in your house that's plugged in can be accessed and queried.
Yeah, and just over the last few months, there's really been a huge increase in the amount of talk about liberating the internet from the PC so that you can take it on your cell phone and even listen to internet radio programs like this over your cell phone. And from my perspective personally at the moment, that is scary for me in the sense that at the moment we don't have reasonable access to those little appliances, and that's why it's absolutely essential that we get there.
Exactly. So I worry about, you know, things like security and monitoring. Does that mean that everybody or that somebody who wants to can log in and figure out everything that's in my house and do an inventory and learn all sorts of things? But I don't know. I suppose somebody will worry about the security part. I hope somebody will. But the fascinating part is that things could be so much easier. You can design things that when they break, they log in. And you walk over to the coffee pot. When it doesn't work, you just push the help button, maybe even the little green diamond button. And if it's not working, the little web server, if it's still working, automatically logs in. And you can ask the coffee pot what's wrong. And the coffee pot, support center can come back and tell you, well, do this, and no, I've got to go buy a new one, this one's dead. Or, the problem is that you pushed the wrong button and you set the timer, and so it's not turning on because you've got it in timer mode, so it's waiting until that time to turn on, or whatever other silly mistake you made.
It may have a psychosis because its owner doesn't understand it.
That's right.
Yes. It's like that old kid's story about the little porridge pot that wouldn't stop boiling. Maybe its microprocessor went wrong or something like that. I never thought of it.
There you go. Well, if you have a neurotic house. Anyway.
Some of us have that.
In 10 years, I hope we have, first of all, products which can be used by people who have low vision, blindness, and other disabilities, simply because it's easy to build access into them, and we've been able to make the case for it. Number two, it would be nice if we had AIDS, and so people did have the ability to use alternate interfaces. And again, it's not just people with disabilities. I could be sitting downstairs and say, "Ah, forgot to turn the coffee pot off," and I pick up my remote, which is now not just the remote for my TV and my VCR, but for most things in my house. And I would log in. And, of course, there would be a security code, and it would be a huge number, and so you don't have everybody and their cousin turning your coffee pot on, but you log into your coffee pot, and you turn it off. Did you say, is it on? It says, yeah, you turn it off. And it's just a handy thing to do for somebody who's lazy. Or you'll get up in the morning, and you just pick up the thing and you punch coffee pot and turn it on. Now you don't have to sit there and, you know, wire it up every night to turn on when you want it. In the morning, you just get on and you just turn it on when you get up as you head into the bathroom. And you don't even have to punch buttons. You just walk in the bathroom and you just say, you know, house, and it says, yeah, and you'd say, turn the coffee pot on.
Well, that is, and obviously that kind of access has benefits for all sorts of groups of people with disabilities, as well as just the convenience factor for everyone.
Yeah, the best thing that people with disabilities have going for them is lazy people, because television remote controls are just tremendous for people with mobility and also visual and disabilities, And nobody created those for people with disabilities. So this is the kinds of things we can look forward to, is continual making the world easier.
Just as we wrap this up, do you have any recommendations as to resources, particularly web-based resources, that people can consult to find out about developments in this area? Perhaps they might be talking to a particular manufacturer that they've encountered when they've purchased an appliance that isn't working, and they might want to say, well, you should take a look at this particular website or something. Where can people go to find out more?
The best reference that we have is to go to trace.wisc.edu. And to look at, right on the homepage, we have Designing a More Usable World for All. And that, if you click on that, you get to a page that says, you know, telecommunications, kiosks, computers, even recreation and trails. And the those links then take you off to other places. For example, you hit recreation there, and it doesn't come to our side, doesn't stay on our side. It jumps off and goes off to a site that is working on that. We try to keep track of all of the key players in each of those areas, and then it just put lots of pointers off of it. And it's not always everything, but it's the the sort of the best we can do. And I don't know of any other site that really is trying to do that. If you're looking just for assistive technologies, then you can go to www.abledata.com, and that will get you into a big directory of all the assistive technologies in the United States. There's also www.dinf.com, which is an attempt to, it's the beginnings of an international disability information site. And there's one going up at Georgia Tech, and I don't have the pointer for that. But for universal design, if you will, there's a center at North Carolina on universal design. But again, you can get that link off of off the trace.wisc.edu site.
Well, this is a topic that obviously concerns many of us, and I know it's been a fascinating hour or so that we've spent. I appreciate you giving up your time to come on the program.